I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
The instantly recognisable voice of Neville Chamberlain kicks off this Radio Wivenhoe special programme on Eastern Angle's latest play, Private Resistance, which comes to the William Lovelace Hall on the 17th and 18th of February. My name's Matthew Lindley, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so as I find out a little bit more about the play and the incredible story of Churchill's guerrilla army, the auxiliary units, that lies behind it. We'll also be playing some of the fabulous music from the period, and including a track a little later on, recorded specially for this programme by Fiona Mason and Simon Hurley. First though, let's have some music. Written in 1939, this is strictly speaking a city song, but as a popular song of the 1940s, it's a good place to start. Here's Anne Shelton's version of a song that's now been covered by everyone from Vera Lynn to Twiggy, A Nightingale's Song in Berkeley Square.
Berkeley Square. Hi, my name is Ivan Cutting. I'm the artistic director of Eastern Angles and the writer of Private Resistance.
So tell us, Ivan, a little bit about how Private Resistance came into being.
Well, it was a long time ago, about 1986, when I was doing interviews for a show that we called On the Home Front, which was about life here during the World War II. And I went off to see a guy who I expected to tell me about being in the Home Guard. But when I got there, he immediately started telling me that he was not quite in the Home Guard, but that he was in this special unit called the Auxiliary Units. And the idea, their idea was that they would go down, dig a bunker and disappear behind the lines if the Germans invaded, and then pop up sort of 10 days later and start blowing up railway lines and supply depots. And they had mammoth amounts of high explosives stored down there with them, and they even had access to guns and so forth, far in advance of what the Home Guard had, in fact. And they went away on training missions, and the wives thought they were having affairs. And this actually developed over a number of years. Because the Germans didn't invade, then obviously they kind of refined all their training and what they could do, and they had special guns made and so forth. We used it in the show, but only for about a couple of minutes, and I thought it was too good to waste for that. And so ever since then, I've been thinking, how might we revisit this period? In the end, I kind of thought, well, I just started writing something myself. I'd read some books about the French Resistance and realised how different that was to what we actually see on television. They didn't immediately start running around with machine guns and blowing up railway lines. In fact, they had very little high explosive at all, and it was much more about the propaganda war and doing things like chalking V's on the back of German trucks, basically bolstering their whole sense of confidence about what they might be able to do.
So the play kind of mixes fact with fiction, doesn't it, in terms of imagining that the Germans
Absolutely.
Have indeed invaded?
Absolutely. It's a what-if scenario. And so we've taken some fairly basic things that are different. So we assume that Dunkirk is a real failure, that the men are captured and they don't get back here. So we are kind of denuded of an army, not just the equipment, but also trained men. It also takes into account that, therefore, the Germans might have been more persistent during the Battle of Britain and not diverted to bombing London. The result of that, of course, is that everything then changes from about September onwards, because that's when the Germans had their Operation Sea Lion. Their plan was to invade on the south coast with barges, to circle around London and to cross the Thames at Dagenham, I believe, and actually sort of come up as far as Chelmsford. I've tried not to get too involved with what the military alternatives
I was going to say,
because
that's a big picture that you're creating. So how do you then narrow that down into the world of the play?
Well, we narrow it down by centering on one house, basically, and it's a story of a woman whose husband has been captured at Dunkirk, a doctor, and so she's without him. She has not a son, but a kind of a son of her sister staying with her because her sister's died and her brother-in-law is away with the Navy. Also, a young girl, an ATS girl, comes to billet with her because she's got a large house because it was the doctor's surgery. And there's also, she has a brother-in-law around of her husband, a brother of her husband who's, you know, militarily involved, although got a gammy leg, so he's not actually fighting. And then there's the local gamekeeper who gets involved with the auxiliary units and recruits Wilf, her nephew, young nephew, who's a scout. And so it kind of depicts that sense of people being flung together in kind of artificial families that I think happened during World War II and enables us to create a story.
And it does turn into quite a story. But before we meet some of the characters and hear from the auxiliary soldier whose oral history inspired Private Resistance, let's have some more music from the period. Though written in 1917, Bless 'Em All was first recorded by George Formby in the 1940s, and it became one of the most famous of all the wartime sing-along songs. Here it is, then, in a version by Billy Cotton and his band.
Nobody knows what a twerp can be. Dankers, oh, what a life.
They say there's a troop ship just leaving Bombay, bound for old Blighty Shore. Heavily laden with time-expired men, bound for the land they adore. Now there's many a soldier just finishing his time, there's many a twerp signing on. But you'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Bless 'em all, bless 'em all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s. Bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, cause we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their village they crawl. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up my lads, bless them all.
Danker, oh what a life.
They say if you work hard you'll get better pay.
We've heard it all before.
Clean up your buttons and polish your boots. Scrub out the barrack room floor. Now there's many a rookie has taken it in, hook, line and sinker and all. But you'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up my lads, bless them all. Bless them all, bless them all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s. Bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, cause we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their village they crawl. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up my lads, bless them all.
We shall fight in France, we shall fight on the seas and oceans, we shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air, we shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender, and if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
The auxiliary units were created in 1940 by Winston Churchill for a very specific purpose. In the event of the British Army having to give ground to invading German forces, the men of the auxiliary unit patrols were to emerge from their underground OBs to continue fighting behind the lines. Had such an invasion taken place, the survival of the auxiliary unit's patrol would depend upon remaining undetected while creating as much havoc as possible behind enemy lines. Everything about the auxiliary units was top secret. In fact, their existence wasn't even acknowledged until some 50 years after the war. The men signed the Official Secrets Act and were also told that should the Germans invade, their life expectancy and the life expectancy of their families was about 2 weeks. The germ of the idea for private resistance came from a reminiscence interview carried out as research for the Eastern Angle show On the Home Front. The recording isn't always of the highest quality, but here the interviewee explains to Ivan how he was recruited by the parson's son from St. Osyth.
When the British troops came out of Norway, we were then formed, the underground movement was formed. Andrew Croft, Colonel Croft, was the parson's son from St. Osyth. He arrived back on the Sunday, he telephoned me and said, "Will you do a job?" Me, I said, "Yes, what's involved is giving 6 chaps who you can trust personally, so I don't mind about their criminal records. They've got to know how to move from Harwich to Brightonsea in the dark." I said, "All right, I can do that. It shall be done Wednesday morning." I said, "I have 6 blokes ready."
That was all the instructions he gave you?
That's all the instructions he gave me.
So you didn't know what on earth it was about?
No. And rescued, they rescued about, two or three hundredweight of explosives. Detonators, gelatinite, plastic explosive, and there an Australian sergeant was sent down to instruct us.
Mm-hmm.
Elementary. We then were given a free hand to practice and do what we like, but to get conversant with it.
How long was the Australian sergeant with you?
Oh, only just a day. He also then instructed us in the at a later date, at sundry times, how to get rid of a German sentry quietly.
And how was that?
Well, there were all sorts of them, not very savoury methods, but I mean, we were taught self-defence, this nighttime aggression, and we were issued with all the clobber, various things, motorbicycle spokes, stockings, and all the ways of disposing of a sentry, how we had to do it. Our instructions were never to come on the surface or do anything overt. Colonel Croft then came down.
And he explained the purpose?
He explained us the purpose.
Which was?
Which was to be ready to disappear and be prepared to stop away for 3 weeks, if necessary. To harass any lines, if there was a landing, harass the lines of communication, to take every opportunity of killing a German silently, quietly, or not being noticed, with all the trickery and to our ability.
Mm-hmm.
To only move at night, never let in having an explosion while we're there.
Mm.
Everything was on a delayed basis.
Mm-hmm.
Because we shouldn't have lasted 10 minutes otherwise.
Mm.
So we had to be and of course our women folk were put out of the way. It was a long time before they realised we were doing anything different.
That was an extract from the oral history recording which inspired the writing of Private Resistance, Ethan Engel's latest show. We'll be hearing more from that recording later in the programme. In that particular clip, we heard about Colonel Croft, the recruiting officer. So now, let's hear about his equivalent character in Private Resistance.
My name is Matt Addis, and I'm playing Tom, who is an ex-army major who didn't serve in the First World War but joined up soon after and has been invalided out of the army after some damage to his knee, so is now a gentleman farmer of sorts.
And have you found creating the character?
Well, it's a fascinating period of our history anyway. I think there's so much written and so much action and adventure that it's been really fun to explore. And then this play does a very intriguing thing of taking that world and then throwing us into another possibility. Sort of in our research, it's been sort of surprising to us all, I think, how vulnerable the UK was at the time of Dunkirk. If Hitler had not wanted to sort of negotiate a truce between his empire and the British one, then he could have invaded, you know, it's sort of in terms of what he needed militarily to do it, that was probably all there. And if he'd made the decision and was gung-ho to do it, it could have happened and we really would have been defenceless at that stage.
So how are you finding this kind of line between fact and fiction?
We're very lucky in that, as well as a terrific script, there are a number of novels or explorations of what would have happened by people who were very closely involved. I've been reading a lot of Operation Sea Lion by Peter Fleming, Ian Fleming's brother, who was very closely involved both with the setup of the auxiliary units and in terms of planning against what became known as Operation Sea Lion after the war. And so a lot of very well-informed minds and sort of experienced people have put together their ideas of what could have happened.
So how's that research and that kind of thinking translating into the rehearsal room?
It's been really vital for us to understand the pressures people were under, what normality felt like, and also how very real that threat of invasion was to some of the people who were involved. And certainly the people we're researching and we're portraying in this, in the auxiliaries, had to believe that it was a reality, had to prepare very seriously for this to be happening and then being the last line of defence. And I think that's quite chilling, the idea that it rested on their shoulders. These, in a lot of cases, were not trained soldiers, people who operated with their military hierarchy. They were fighting a guerrilla war if this came to it. And the preparations they made, the level of training they did.
And how much did you know about the auxiliary unit before you started work on private resistance?
Absolutely zero.
So it's been a bit of a journey then over the
last... Yeah, a huge eye-opener. And I sort of started with basically understanding Coles Hill and then worked into the sort of government organisational side of it. Luckily, we've been very well supplied with diaries and reports, and Ivan did some interviews with an auxiliary who talked very openly about this some time ago. And I mean, I certainly was his inspiration, I think, for the play, and has really helped us paint a picture of these men who, even to their own families, some of them hadn't disclosed the secret until 50 years after the war.
So there were underground movements all the way around the coast?
All the way around, right away around from Folkestone.
Did you ever meet them?
Oh yes, we used to go out and meet, yes. And we used to have exercises with them.
Yes.
We had one with, because let's see, like Paxman's had a unit.
Paxman's?
Paxman's, you know, the Boilermakers, mm-hmm. in Colchester. They had a unit. There was next unit, was Manningtree, there was one at Brightlingsea, and then they went out round Malden, mm-hmm. all the way round. So you've got units all the way around the country, yeah. right from down to from the other side of Folkestone, right through to Scotland. Mm-hmm. We never met them. We used to meet, you know, at various places. We met casually,
yeah.
and you know, said, "Oh, so and so will be there. He's one of them." And of course, we had we used to go down to were sent down on courses, demolition courses to Coles Hill. In just outside Swindon. Well, we used to go down there for a long weekend and we would then put through the, how to do it.
Yes.
Well,
this would be blowing up railway lines.
Blowing up railway lines, smashing up steam engines, getting into the place. That was the chief thing, was moving at night.
Forget to wake me in the morning and bring me round a nice hot cup of tea. Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Sergeant Major, be a mother to me. Private Jones came in one night, full of cheer and very bright. He'd been out all day upon the spree. He bumped into Sergeant Smeck and put his arms around his neck, and in his ears he whispered tenderly, "Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Ooh, my head is going round and round. Sing me to sleep, Sergeant Major. You're the swellest pal I've ever found. Now call round for the empties in the morning. There'll be 30 bob to come. And don't forget that nice strong cup of tea, lad. Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Sergeant Major, be a mother to me. Oh, pal. Forget to wake me in the morning and bring me round a nice hot cup of tea. Kiss me. me good night, Sergeant Major. Sergeant Major, be a mother to me.